If you have a cell phone, you might want to turn it down, put it on vibrate, shut it off, throw it away, whatever you need to do, so that it doesn't distract us while we study together. Genesis 38. We have seen so far in the life of Jacob that he supplanted his children. So far, we have seen them lie to and murder all the men of a single town and then steal and loot all of their flocks, their herds, their donkeys, all the women and the little ones and the houses. And then we have seen these same sons of Jacob's sell their very own brother into slavery at a discounted price. Toward the end of this story is the story of Judah and Tamar in Genesis 38. I'd like to tell you things get better now, but they do not. Genesis 38. It came about at that time when they had sold Joseph that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went into her. What's the problem with that? She's a Canaanite. I asked the question, what's the problem with that? And the answer is, she's a Canaanite. Judah here is breaking down some barriers. A few years ago, there was a catastrophe in Louisiana. This hurricane came in and broke through a levee. And what happened? The walls came tumbling down. Well, same thing here. He marries this certain Canaanite. And the next thing you know, verse 6, Judah took a wife for Er, his firstborn. Her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life. I don't think there's any mistake that you see him, the father, marrying a Canaanite, and knowing his background already, he marries a Canaanite, and next thing you know, the child is sentenced to death by the Lord himself. Okay, then Judah said to Onan, his brother, the younger brother, go into your brother's wife and perform your duty as brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your brother. This is something called levirate marriage. And believe it or not, it was in Hungary within the last 1,000 years, which I was surprised to learn of when I was there in Hungary, but used that when I was there in Hungary also. Levirate marriage is where you've got multiple brothers, one wife, the oldest brother dies without having a child. The wife is taken by the next brother, and she is to produce, or they together are to produce, an offspring that will assume the rights and responsibilities as if the firstborn had a child. I hope that makes sense. But that's what happens. To us, that's very strange, but to them, it was quite common. Now, for those of you who are interested in how this next passage relates to family planning, remember, purpose matters, and listen to the language. Onan knew that his offspring would not be his. So, he went into his brother's wife, he wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. There's your purpose statement. But what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord. So he took his life also. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up. For he thought, I'm afraid that he too may die like his brothers. So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. Okay, he has the responsibility to provide Tamar with a husband again, and it would be this guy Shelah, but Judah thinks it's Tamar's fault that everybody's dying, when it's more probably his own fault than hers. So he says, you just wait, you go back to your dad's house, and you wait, and I'll give you a phone call. Don't call me, I'll call you. But he's already thinking, maybe I won't, because he's afraid, too, that he might die like his brother. Now, after a considerable time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. And when the time of mourning was ended, Judah went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah, and his friend Hira, the Adullamite. he and his friend here, the Adullamite. And it was told to Tamar, "Behold, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep." So she removed her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil and wrapped herself and sat in the gateway of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah had grown up, and she had not given him she had not been given to him as a wife. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, for she had covered her face. So he turned aside to her on the road and said, "Here now, let me come into you." For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, "What will you give me that you may come into me?" And he said, "Therefore, I will send you a young goat from the flock." She said, "Moreover, will you give a pledge until you send it?" And he said, "What pledge shall I give you?" And she said, "Your seal and your cord and your staff that is in your hand." So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and departed and removed her veil and put on her widow's garments. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite to receive the pledge from the widow woman's hand, he did not find her. He asked the men of her place, saying, "Where is the temple prostitute that was by the road?" And they said, "There has been no temple prostitute here." And so he returned to Judah and said, "I did not find her." Furthermore, the men of the place said, "There has been no temple prostitute here." And Judah said, "Let her keep them. Otherwise, we will become a laughingstock. After all, I sent this young goat, but you did not find her." Now, it's about 3 months later that Judah was informed, "Your daughter-in-law, Tamar, has played the harlot. And behold, she is with child by harlotry." And Judah said, "Bring her out and let her be burned." Now, that is probably not being burned to death, but probably some kind of a branding was what we would call it. I don't know for sure, but it's probably more of a branding from what I have read. It was while she was being brought out that she sent to her father-in-law and said, "I am with child by the man to whom these things belong." And she said, "Please examine and see whose signet ring and cords and staff are these." And Judah recognized them and said, "She is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah, and he did not have relations with her again." Just remember that for later. It came about at the time she was giving birth that, behold, there were twins in her womb. Moreover, it took place that while she was giving birth, one put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, "This one came out first." But it came about as he drew back his hand that, behold, his brother came out. She said, "What a breach you have made for yourself." So he was named Perez. Afterward, his brother came out who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and he was named Zerah. Okay, here we have basically the last story in a whole string of chaos. It begins with the breaking of barriers and depravity, and it ends with two illegitimate children fathered in an incestuous relationship. And if you don't want to look at it that way, then you can look at it also fathered by a harlot. This is getting from horrible to even worse as we go on. So the question is, we've seen Israel, the nation, the 12 patriarchs. We've seen all that they're doing. And it's chaos and crazy. And the question is, how is the Lord going to stop this from getting any worse? Do you know the answer? 400 years of hard labor. Discipline, training. Yes, that's what will happen. Well, what are you thinking about? Yeah, okay. I thought you meant before. I was trying to figure out what before. Right. Yeah, at least one other time. All right. A few things about Judah. Basically, we've looked at the text. I want to share some of my thoughts about Judah. First of all, the great disaster, okay? Judah rejected God's precedent when he married a Canaanite. Okay, God had been saying, "Don't do this, don't do this, don't do this," and yet he goes and does it. So he rejects the precedent there. So he's got a little bit of rebellion in him. He raised children who were fit only to die. Now, that is not only his fault, but given the rest of the stories, the circumstances, it seems that he was pretty much involved in their outcome. Notice Manasseh. If you think, I asked once a biblical scholar, who do you think the worst person is in the Old Testament? Then automatically they said Manasseh. You can argue that, I don't know, but you notice Manasseh wasn't condemned to death, was he? And in the end, he repented. Yeah. Yeah. Right. He lied to, treated unfairly his daughter-in-law. He was a hypocrite. He said, "You're guilty. Come out here and let her be burned." And then when he was implicated, he said, "Oh, well, she's better than I am," which there is some sign in there. I say he probably involved in the pillaging of the Shechemites, question mark. I don't really know if he was. At one point it says Simeon and Levi, and another point it says his sons did the pillaging. I don't know. Maybe I should strike that. He sold his brother Joseph at a discounted rate. He's the one that suggested it. And then he let his father suffer depression for years. Now, among others, but he himself was guilty of the same crime. So, I don't think he's the worst man in the Old Testament, but guess what? I don't think he knows the Beatitudes very well, does he? He doesn't have them memorized. Do you want your son hanging out with Judah? Do you want your daughter coming home and saying, "Guess what, Mommy, I've got a new beau. His name is Judah." No. So the question is, how is this guy the great patriarch? And let me emphasize it this way. The atheist's seven virtues. Be mindful of others. What is their situation? How are they doing? How are they faring? Be compassionate. Be rational. Be truthful. Be passionate. Compassionate, rational, truthful, passionate. I don't know what I think I said one twice. Be just and be humble in light of the creation, not the creator. Okay, so forget about that for a minute. Now, which of these is Judah? Is he mindful? Is he looking out for others and saying, "What's their situation? How are they doing? I wonder how I can help them." I don't get that impression from Judah. Yeah, he might be rational. Is he truthful? No. He's lying to basically everybody around him. Is he passionate? Yeah, about anything that has to do with himself.
For the wrong things.
Yeah, for the wrong things. Is he just? No. Is he humble? I don't get the impression that he's humble. So the question is, how? How is it that this man can be God's great patriarch? I think there's a hint in our text today, but I think you get the real answers in the text that is to come later on. So, I would just ask you for now, keep this in mind. How is it possible that God uses this guy and we think so highly of him? In the meantime,
what's going on with the title of the Great Patriarch? Is he called that somewhere?
No.
Okay.
No. But, I mean, the esteem that they held the patriarchs in is what I was alluding to, like Acts. Okay, Tamar, a lesson about God's preference. All right, you can skip this first line if you want. Assuming Tamar could have chosen to stay with God's chosen family. Remember, this is God's chosen family, part of it. He says to her, "Go away." So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. Whether or not Tamar could have chosen it actually doesn't matter for the points that we're going to make. We know this. Judah had not given Tamar any reason to stay. Remember, he's part of God's chosen family. Could you imagine Judah going around saying, "Oh yes, we're going to inherit the land someday because we're God's chosen family"? Everybody would look at him and say, "Well, you know, you're crazy," or something. I don't know what they'd say. But Tamar, is Judah projecting a loving, God-fearing, love your brother, do what's best for them? No. He didn't give Tamar any reason to stay. Here's the question. What impression do we give others? We are Christians, and we are a local congregation of Christ's people. People are watching. So the question is, what kind of... Are we like the school child, the bad school child that everybody knows about, that everybody talks about? Or the bad school, or whatever, the bad business. You know, are we the Enron? People are watching. Tamar's behavior seemed to indicate she wasn't jumping at the chance to stay with the Lord's people. When he said go, she went, and then later on she's doing things that the Lord's people shouldn't be doing. Contrast that with Ruth. You remember the story of Ruth? The first chapter, the end of the first chapter, what is Ruth doing? Staying and begging to stay. "Please don't tell me to go away. I'm not going to go away because your God will be my God and Your people will be my people. Okay, so we see a difference in Ruth and God's family. Now, Ruth was also in a situation where she was widowed. How did she go about getting a man? She could have done the same thing, tricked somebody into having her child or something like that. But what does she do? She goes out and does it in a way that doesn't require any sin whatsoever. And you remember the end of Ruth's story? Summarize the end of Ruth's story.
It did well for her.
She married a godly man. It went well for her. We would say they lived happily ever after.
And the lineage thing.
Right.
I mean, that's a big deal when you're a Jew.
Right. Okay. They lived happily ever after. Do you remember the last words between Jodah and Tamar were, they did not have relations again? Now, they shouldn't have to begin with, but you don't get the picture of happily ever after in that family situation. Whereas when Ruth was doing things God's way, she was happy. And God wanted everybody to be happy always, and if they just do things God's way, He will provide happiness for them. Also, notice this. In the book of Ruth, the word God or Lord is used 22 times. 20 of them are in quotations. In other words, they're saying God, Lord. The other times are about God's providence, okay? In the story of Judah and Tamar, God and Lord are used, actually, Lord is used 3 times and He is used once. And it has to do with condemnation of the 2 sons. You've heard the expression, the family that prays together stays together. Judah and Tamar and those people in that situation aren't using the word God. They're not throwing it around like they ought to be. Whereas in Ruth, it's in their daily conversation. They're talking about God, bringing Him into their conversation all the time. No surprise there. How do I get from Judah and Tamar to Jesus? Right. These 2 illegitimate children that we just talked about, Matthew 1. Matthew 1, verse 3. Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. And then you follow it on down and Jesus comes through. Okay. Some people wonder, why in the world does Judah, other than the fact that Jesus is in his lineage, or excuse me, he is in Jesus' lineage, why does it bring up the father of Perez and Zerah, both of them? Some people wonder, why does he bring up 4 women? Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and Bathsheba. Of those 4 women, what do each of them have against them? I didn't get that. Okay, Tamar, not a good situation. You read Genesis 38 and you say, oh man, that's in the genealogy of the Christ. Ruth, what is her strike against her? It's not a big one, but for them it would have been.
Moabite.
She's a Moabite. Okay. Rahab, right? And Bathsheba, not a very good situation, right? Okay. What did the Jews at the time Christ lived think of themselves? They thought, especially the scribes and the Pharisees, thought that they were just perfect. We have never been in slavery. Some have surmised that Matthew, when he wrote this genealogy, included some of these people just as a smack in the face, saying, look, your history and you people aren't as great as you think you were. Matthew chapter 12, they say he casts out demons by the ruler of demons, and he says, you're depraved. And they come right back to him and say, we want another sign. And he says, an evil and adulterous generation seeks a sign. So he's saying, look, you're evil people, really. We could go to these other passages. Matthew 12, Isaiah 13 through 24. It emphasizes how corrupt the world was at the time they were sent into Babylon. Hosea does too. There's no faithfulness in the land, Hosea says. When Jesus came, He came, He was a tender shoot in the midst of a parched ground. In other words, it was an evil time that Jesus came in, Sin all around him, yet what? How did he live his life? Sinlessly. So we have our precedent to be different in what we do, and at the same time, to be different with whom we do it. You know the WWJD. What am I talking about?
What would Jesus do?
It's fantastic. Live by it. I would also say whom would he do it with? With whom would Jesus do it? Or whatever you want to say. You know, your friends matter. It matters who you have for friends. Comments or questions on what we have said here? Okay. Back here in Genesis 39, the questions were so straightforward that if you couldn't understand them, then there's no help for me. Any questions or any comments about the questions? Okay.
Just number 10, what was Joseph's attitude? And I came up with a little thing before I took that example, but I was wondering what you were looking for.
Different things would have worked, but I wrote down forgetful. You know, he. I'll say he forgave and forget, although I don't want to push that too far.
I'll say he's very thankful.
Yeah.
That's what I had too.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll talk more about that in a little while. I mean, I just put down that one word there because of the names of his children is what I was thinking of. Okay. All right. Back here in Genesis 39. Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. We're picking up where that story had left off. Genesis 37 is... Genesis 38 is thrown in there parenthetically like. I'm going to go through this, and I'm going to share some relevant thoughts at the same time, and then we'll talk more at the end. Maybe you have something. Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. By the way, on whether or not he was sold to an Ishmaelite or a Midianite, which was in chapter 37, verse 28. The Midianite traders passed by, and so they sold them to the Ishmaelites. They are different families, distinct different families. But I learned something recently in trying to figure this out. Do you know what the word Arab means? Mixed. Arabians are mixed people. Abraham, when he kept on having children, those who were not Isaac, what did he do with them? He sent them east. And they all go out east, and they all hang out together. They're Arabs together. They're mixed. And so we see this here. So not surprising to learn that. Anyway, verse 2. The Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man. What we understand here is that God is still involved. This is behind the scenes look. And the consequence of him being with Joseph is, so he became a successful or prosperous man. Let me stop here for a minute. Who remembers who Baruch was? I say Baruch. Jeremiah's scribe. What do you say? Baruch? Barak. Yeah, so I knew that. Who remembers who Barak was? Okay. Do you remember Jeremiah 45? 5 verses long. God comes and says to Baruch, what does he say to him? You're trying to get ahead, and you're trying to get ahead, and you're trying to get ahead, and it's not going to happen. I will give you your life as booty everywhere you go. In other words, God was with him, but he didn't get to be prosperous. So I guess it's God's prerogative, isn't it? Right. Right. Yeah, so varying degrees of prosperity. Joseph gets his life and prosperity, and eventually he'll get mega prosperity. Baruch never got that, so it's up to God, whatever he wants for people. The question is, how can I best serve him? And the answer is, God knows, so just be content with it. So, verse 2, he was in the house of his master the Egyptian. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him and how the Lord had caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant, and he made him overseer over his house. And all that he owned, he put in his charge. It came about from that time, from the time he made him overseer in his house and over all that he owned, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. You remember the blessing, part of the blessing that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob receive is that their families will be the Midas touch in the world. Everywhere they go, they're going to be helping people. I don't mean Midas touch as in making them rich, but blessing them, a blessing for the earth. Well, here's an illustration of that. By the way, Reuben, Simeon, and Levi all brought shame to the houses they were involved with. Joseph, thousands of miles away, is the exact opposite, emphasizing his faithfulness and the fact that it's a choice that we all have to make. What kind of person am I going to be? Notice God used them all. It didn't matter who it was, God used them. But would he prefer to use the one who's faithful over the one that's unfaithful? Or maybe I should ask, wouldn't he prefer that everybody he used was faithful? Yeah, right. So again, the question is, where do I fit in? And with regards to prosperity, God determines that. But with regards to righteousness, I determine that. I determine whether or not I'm going to do what God says. Okay, so he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge, and with him there he did not concern himself with anything except for the food which he ate. Now Joseph was not only successful, but handsome and in form and appearance, and he is what you call a target. It came out after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me." Now, in a promiscuous society, which Egypt was, this was not unusual. Okay? At the same time, recognize this for what it is. She is married, and so what does that make this? Adultery. So she's offering adultery to him. Verse 8. But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put all that he owns in my charge. There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God?" By the way, what would Reuben and Judah's answers possibly have been? Again, emphasizing the difference between Joseph and his brothers. Verse 11. Now it happened one day. I'm sorry, verse 10. I skipped an important verse. And she spoke to Joseph day after day, and he did not listen to her or lie with her or be with her. He will be in that house apparently somewhere around 9 years. Maybe not quite 9 years, but a long time. When he's in prison, it'll have been, well, 30 minus 3. So something like 7-8 years that he's been there already when he's in prison. I'm sorry, I just made a mistake. He's there in the land. He's 17 when he goes into Egypt. He's 30 when he starts before Pharaoh. He's in prison for at least 2 years, because it says 2 years, and a little bit more. So it seems like he's in prison for 3 years, which leaves the rest of the time maybe at Pharaoh's house. Yeah. Right. That assumes that he showed up in Egypt, and as soon as he showed up in Egypt, he went to Pharaoh's house, which that might be a safe assumption. Anyway, a long time. So, day after day, for how long? I don't know. But it could have been 9 years for him. Finally, her obsession escalates. She called him in verse 12 by his garment and said, "Lie with me." And he left his garment in her hand and fled and went outside. And when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, she called to the men of the household and said to them, "See, he has brought in a Hebrew to us to make sport of us. He came into me to lie with me, and I screamed. When he heard I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and fled and went outside." So she left his garment beside him, her, until his master came home. Then she spoke to him with these words, "The Hebrew slave whom you brought to us came into me to make sport of me. And as I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and fled outside." Now when his master heard the words of his wife, which she spoke to him, saying, "This is what your slave did to me," his anger burned. So Joseph's master took him and put him into jail, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in jail. This is not supposed to be. Joseph is the good guy. And Joseph is in prison. But at the same time, Joseph was the good guy and was sold into slavery. Among other points, we could make one that we usually make. Bad things happen to good people. This is the way life goes. Okay. Verse 21. But the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindnesses to him. Two things about this. Every time something terrible happens to Joseph, who's right there with him? Do you know that somewhat cliche? It's usually in the bathroom. What am I talking about?
Footsteps in the sand.
Do you know the footsteps in the sand poem? Where there's footsteps in the sand, there's two of them, and then there's one. And the person saying, why is it, Lord, that when I'm having such problems, there's only one? And God says to him, it was that time that I was carrying you. Maybe cliche, but very, very, very appropriate. And he recognizes it, too. More about that later. Verse 22, the chief jailer committed to Joseph's charge all of the prisoners who were in jail. So that whatever was done there, he was responsible for it. 23, the chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. Whatever he did, the Lord made him to prosper. Joseph is floating to the top again. He's always rising to the top. All right, he's in prison. Notice from verse 20, it was the place where the king's prisoners were confined. So this is not where the commoners are. The king has some interest in these people. That'll be for later. Yeah?
Yeah, I don't know. That brings up a point of speculation. Why didn't Joseph just put him down? Did he hear God? Did he hear God?
Yeah.
In some way? You know, he sees that Joseph's God is with him. He's prospering. You know, maybe I should speculation.
Yep. Maybe. Okay, you're right. He does know that God is with him, but elsewhere we see that it's in the Proverbs 6:7, something like that, that one man who commits adultery with another man's wife, that man, that husband, will never forget it. Anyway, so here, he's in the king's prison, and then come the cupbearer and the chief baker, and they each have a dream. One has a dream where he's preparing grape juice and serves it to the king. The other has a dream that he's preparing bread and then the birds come and eat the bread. The interpretation of the dream, verse 13, within 3 more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office, the cupbearer. And you will put Pharaoh's cup into his hand according to your former custom when you were his cupbearer. Only keep me in mind when it goes well with you, and please do me a kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house. For I was in fact kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I have done nothing wrong, or done nothing that they should put me into the dungeon. Well, the chief baker says, hey, that's a favorable outcome, I want to ask. And verse 18, Joseph answered, this is its interpretation. By the way, in verse 8, Joseph had said, do not interpretations belong to God? So he's giving credit where credit is due. And this is its interpretation. The 3 baskets are 3 days. Within 3 more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from you and will hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh off of you. Thus it came about on the 3rd day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, that he made the feast for all his servants, and he lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants. And he restored the chief cupbearer to his office, and he put the cup into Pharaoh's hand, but he hanged the chief baker, just as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. So there's a little pun in there. Joseph makes, both your heads are going to be lifted up, but in 2 completely different ways. In that he said, hey, remember me, but he is forgotten. Chapter 41, at the end of 2 full years, so he's in prison for 2 years at least, Pharaoh has a dream, or several dreams, Seven cows, fat ones, seven cows, skinny ones. The skinny ones eat the fat ones. That's unusual. And then seven ears of corn and seven thin ears of corn. And the seven thin ears of corn swallow up the seven plump and full ears. And that, too, is unusual. I know that myself. Pharaoh woke, and behold, it was a dream. Now in the morning, verse 8, his spirit was troubled, and he sent and called for the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men. And Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was no one who could interpret them to Pharaoh. And guess who remembers who? The cupbearer remembers Joseph. Verse 14, Pharaoh sent and called for Joseph, and he hurriedly brought him out of the dungeon, and when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came to Pharaoh. Stop here for a moment. This is the third time a dream will affect Joseph's life, and in this case, it gets him out of prison. Do you remember in Acts chapter 5, there are some people in prison, the apostles, and how does the Lord get them out of the prison? He sends an angel. In other words, what we have here is a varied arsenal. God can send an angel in one case. He can send a dream in another. He can do what he wants. Now, here's the question. Why didn't he send an angel for Joseph? Who has the answer? Okay.
Because he wanted to use a dream.
Excellent. Excellent. I would suggest this, that we'll never know why he wanted to use a dream. Yes, he did want to use a dream with Joseph. But why didn't he just send an angel to do it? We'll never know. God can do it. And we don't have to know. It's what has been revealed that's important to us.
Well, to involve Pharaoh into this scenario, we had to affect Pharaoh somehow. So by giving him a dream that affected Pharaoh, by sending an angel to Pharaoh, that would affect him in a way. Was that to get out?
Well, an angel to the prison.
Yeah, but to affect Pharaoh somehow.
Right.
You know, when Moses goes to Pharaoh, he's saying, get out.
Right. Yep, I agree. Or he could have done this, or he could have done that. But God just chooses. He's got a varied arsenal, and he does what he does in his way, probably right. Don't know for sure. Okay. So, Pharaoh sent and calls for him. And he says, I had a dream. And Joseph answers in verse 25. Pharaoh's dreams are one and the same. God has told Pharaoh what he is about to do. So again, he's giving God the credit. Now, you've read ahead. You know what the story is. It's 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of famine. By the way, when Joseph interprets the dream for him, two things happen here. Who is, or maybe I should ask the question, what is Pharaoh? What? Oh, no, I'm sorry. What kind of a being is Pharaoh?
King?
But what does the name Pharaoh mean? He thinks he's a god. Right, son of Ra or Hera, depending on which you're reading. Okay, Pharaoh is a descendant of the gods. And he can't answer his own dreams from the gods, showing what a sham he is. By the way, these magicians who come in, they can't answer it either. You know the expression, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. The next time these magicians come in, you know what he's going to be thinking? I need Joseph. Take a hike, guys. Okay. Verse 38. I've skipped the recommendation, but verse 38. Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find a man like this in whom is a divine spirit? You know what that says about himself? He's admitting, look, guys, I'm just like you. I'm just like everybody. We're all together, except for this Joseph guy over here. Well, Joseph made a recommendation, get a fifth of the produce of the land each of the 7 years, save it up, and later on people will come and buy from you. Verse 39, so Joseph said to Joseph, since God has informed you of all this, there is no one so discerning and as wise as you are. You shall be over my house, and according to your command, all my people shall do homage. Only in the throne will I be greater than you. Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. And what do we have taking place here? Think back. In his childhood, not so long ago, he had some dreams. And in those dreams,
everyone's going to bow down.
Right. So here we have this dream starting to be fulfilled. His family will still come and bow down to him. Verse 42, Pharaoh took off his signet ring from his hand, put it on Joseph's hand, and clothed him in garments of fine linen, put a gold necklace around his neck. He had him ride in his second chariot, and they proclaimed before him, "Bow the knee." And there you have partial fulfillment. And he set him over all the land of Egypt. Moreover, Pharaoh said to him, "Though I am Pharaoh, yet without your permission, no one shall raise his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." Then Pharaoh named Joseph, basically, God sees, or God speaks, or God knows. What is it? It's Zaphnath-Paneah. And he gave him Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, the priest of On, as his wife. And Joseph went forth over the land of Egypt. Now, stop here for a minute. Do you remember when Joseph was in prison, what did he ask for? "I just want to get out of this house. Just get me out of here, and I'll be satisfied." Oh, I would imagine. Right. Yeah, let me go. Get me out of here. He asks, he says, "Look, get me out of this house." And what does he get? When he waits and when it's in God's time, what does he actually end up with? More than he could have possibly imagined. More than he would have ever have thought to ask for. Ultimately, in our physical lives, God does not necessarily guarantee everybody we're going to have more than we could possibly ask for. But ultimately, you know, the language of heaven is written in such a way that we can't... He's trying to tell us about things we cannot understand because it's so great. God wants to give us the best. Ethan, you want to say something?
Oh, this reminds me of what you were saying before, or just now about... He did more than he could ever ask for or imagine.
Yes, Ephesians. The four qualifiers. More abundantly, greater, even more than that. Very good. Do you have it?
Yeah.
Read it, please.
"Now to him who is able to do more, far more abundantly than we all..." Let me start that over. "Now to him who is able to do far more abundantly than all we ask or think, according to the power that work within us, to him be the glory in the church and in Christ Jesus throughout all generations, forever and ever. Amen."
Yeah. Okay, so the rest of this chapter is Joseph being 30 years old, going out the 7 years of plenty, verse 47, gathering the food in, verse 48, verse 49, storing it all up. Verse 50, "Before the year of the famine came, the two sons were born to Joseph from Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore to him. Joseph named the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, 'God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household.' He named the second Ephraim, for he said, 'God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction.'" So he's forgotten the past, if you will. He doesn't forget it completely. You can't, or he couldn't. He's forgotten the past, and he's content where he is now. "With the 7 years of plenty," which when the land of Egypt came to an end, the 7 years of famine began. And verse 57, "People of all the earth came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe in all the earth." There are, by the way, granaries. There are monuments which represent granaries in Egypt. They have these, they dig them up, archaeologists dig them up, and here's a monument of a granary. Maybe a tribute to this, what we're talking about here. Okay, you know the story. You know what happens next. Go with me to Genesis chapter 50, the very end. Genesis 50, verse 20. He's telling his brothers, after they meet up again, he's telling his brothers, "This is what has happened. You did evil to me." Verse 20. As for you, "You meant evil against me by selling him into slavery, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive." What we've seen here is a story of God's providence. God is mentioned all through this. It is the beginning of God's providential move of Egypt, of Israel to Egypt. But consider this. In God's moving Israel to Egypt, he allowed Joseph to be sold into slavery by his brothers, mistreated that way, and then a slave in Egypt for a period of time, mistreated by this woman, thrown into prison. By the way, Psalm 105:18 says that he was afflicted the whole time. We'll turn there maybe just a minute. But so this prison was no easy thing for him. He was tested by God. All of this so that God's plan could begin to unfold. Some lessons. Three things you already know. We say these often. God uses sinful situations. Be aware of it. God's plan will unfold no matter how many obstacles arise. It doesn't matter how many. It seems like there's obstacle after obstacle after obstacle because there is. Time marches on, doesn't it? You cannot stop time. It just marches on. And God does too. You cannot stop him. And one last thing, our comfort level is not God's primary concern. Comments or questions about what we've talked about? I've skipped over some. I have some points to make, but what do you have to say? George, first.
I was going to say, to the extent that our comfort level is his concern, it's him trying to get us out of it.
That's right. Very good point. He's trying to wake us up and say, hey, you shouldn't be comfortable where you are. Jonathan.
I was going to say, this is another section like Esther, where thing after thing after thing happens that is obviously God doing something, but it's not a miracle.
Right.
Especially, like, it doesn't say when he goes, when Potiphar buys him, it doesn't say how he became prosperous, but you know it wasn't him walking around turning things to gold, because that would have...
It wasn't the Midas touch?
Things would have happened very differently. People would have been like, hey, look at this guy. I want to buy him because he'll turn my stuff to gold.
Yep.
So things happen without...
Yeah, it doesn't have to be a miracle every time. Anyone else? Anything else? A couple small things to say. Our attitude and mistreatment... Turn to Psalm 105. This is a short history of Israel. And in it, the psalmist mentions Joseph's situation. Verse 17, he sent a man before them, Israel, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. They afflicted his feet with fetters, and he himself was laid in irons. So you don't get that from Genesis, but you get it from Psalm, and fetters are no fun, irons are no fun. Yet do you remember the closest thing to ill-mannered that we read of? Maybe he did a whole bunch that we don't read of. I'm not saying that of him at all. I'm just saying I'm allowing for the possibility. The closest thing to an ill-mannered statement he makes is, I've done nothing wrong. That's the closest he gets to, as opposed to he could have jumped up and down and said, those funny people back there, you know what they did to me and you and all this? These passages, we won't take the time to turn to them, but 1 Peter 2, slaves are to be submissive to the masters with all respect, even those who are disobedient to God, because Jesus was. That's 1 Peter chapter 2. It goes on to say that. Matthew chapter 5, which we'll study this week, which you read last week. If somebody slaps you on the cheek, what do? Turn the other cheek. The same idea. You don't retaliate back with them evil for evil. Notice also it says in Psalm 105:19, until the time his word came to pass, the word of the Lord, and my version says, tested, yours might say refined or something like that. What was he doing in prison? Was that wasted 2 years? No. God was testing him that whole time, or God was refining him that whole time. And this brings up our attitude in difficulty, our attitude about difficulty or mistreatment, either way. When we're tested, when you encounter various trials, what is our attitude to be when we encounter various trials? My brethren, consider it all
joy.
What does yours say?
I was disappointed.
Okay, that's fine. Joy. This should be our attitude in trials. Also, It could have been 10 long years that Joseph, or 9, whatever, was Joseph was tempted by this woman. But take the very last temptation there. The very last temptation. How long did that last? 20 minutes. I doubt it, but it will say 20 minutes. Whatever, I don't know. It lasted 20 minutes. How long did prison last? Geology is the study of pressure and time. That's what Satan does. He'll wait. He'll wait. Satan's got all the time. And he's just trying to wear you down. But Joseph, he was a rock. Our attitude in difficulty or life. Life gave Joseph lemons and he... What does he do? Every time. But the Lord was with him and he became prosperous. And he became prosperous and he became prosperous. Every time something's happening to him, he's not letting it get him down. About earthly circumstances, I had a friend, I have a friend, who comes out of Hungary, communist Hungary. His parents, half of his family died in Jewish prison camps. And then he went through communism where many of them had nothing. And now he has 2 houses and a big field, 200 hectares, which is like 400 acres, and a forest. And he says, God loves me. Look at all I have. Now, Potiphar's wife, what did she live in? She had it all. Where was Joseph? In a pit, it says. They took me out of the pit, it says. He's in a dungeon. Who did God love? Well, God loved her. But God was with him. Our attitude in privilege. Every time Joseph was about to do something where he could say, boy, aren't I just a great guy? Look at me. I'm fantastic. What does he do? It's God. God is the one that's going to do this. And then our attitude in temptation. Perspective matters. When she comes to him, he says to her, how could I do this against my master and my God? Do you remember what Jacob said when he is in a moment of temptation? His mother says to him, why don't you go and lie? Why don't you go and do this? And he says, I might get caught. He's saying, look, my God. You know, he was hundreds of miles away from his earthly father. In fact, he was even further away. His heavenly father was in heaven, but he knew his heavenly father was watching all the time and right there. He had problems either way in that house. Either he sinned or he would be slandered. That was his choice. Choose. Do you want to sin or do you want to be slandered? Remember Matthew 10:28? Do not fear those who can kill the body, but him who can kill the body and soul, or destroy the body and soul. Joseph applied that right there. Perseverance matters, day after day. You know, for Joseph, nothing had changed. Every single day he goes in, and this woman is still there doing the same thing. And at the same time, every single day he goes in there and this woman is doing the same thing. You know what he's thinking? My God and my master. Nothing changes for him. Perseverance matters. And then pouncing matters. There's a passage that says something about God will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able, but with the temptation will
escape.
And what did he do? He looked for it and he didn't mess around. He ran out the door. Any comments or questions?
It seems like he's established a pattern of not doing as much as he could not to be around her without other people around. Because it comes in and says that
on the day when
they're out of the house this one time. And then,
yep.
So he would not, in that circumstance, have a chance to properly defend himself. Otherwise, it seems like he was pretty careful.
Yep, I imagine this man was extremely careful, doing whatever. You don't get the picture he was immodestly dressed either. He's wearing his work clothes. Okay. Good. And we'll look forward to next week. Thank you for your comments.